Okay, ready to dive into another case? This one really shows how important a good story is, you know, like a compelling narrative in a discrimination lawsuit. We're looking at Swanson v. Citibank, a case that went all the way up to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals.
Swanson is fascinating. You know, it really grapples with this whole idea of plausibility when it comes to discrimination cases, especially after those big Supreme Court cases, Twombly and Iqbal. Courts have been trying to figure out, well, what's enough to even get a case heard in the first place?
You mean, so you can't just shout discrimination and expect an automatic trial?
That's exactly it. Twombly and Iqbal basically said, hold on, you need more than just a basic accusation. You need a story that actually makes sense, you know, logically.
Okay, so walk me through Gloria Swanson's story then. What happened?
Well, back in 2009, Gloria Swanson, she's an African-American woman, she applied for a home equity loan from Citibank. This was right after the financial crisis, remember, when Citibank got a ton of federal money to, you know, boost lending.
Right.
So Swanson, she gives the bank an estimate of her home's value. But get this, Citibank sends out their own appraiser and the number comes back way lower.
Way lower, huh? How much lower are we talking?
Tens of thousands of dollars less than Swanson's estimate.
Whoa, that's a huge difference. So what did Citibank do?
Well, based on that low appraisal, Citibank denies her the loan, and Swanson, she's suspicious.
Okay.
So she gets her own independent appraisal done, and what do you know? The value comes back much higher, much closer to what she originally estimated. She's convinced Citibank discriminated against her because of her race, that it wasn't just some random appraisal mistake.
So she decided to sue.
Yep. Swanson files a lawsuit against Citibank. She goes after them under the Fair Housing Act, you know, that law that's supposed to prevent discrimination in stuff like housing and lending.
Right.
But she doesn't stop there. She also throws in claims under the Equal Credit Opportunity Act.
Oh, wow. Covering all her bases.
And even a common law fraud claim, just to be sure.
It sounds like she was ready to fight this. So what happened? What did the lower court say?
Well, the district court actually dismissed all of her claims.
All of them?
Yeah. They basically said she didn't have a strong enough case to even go to trial.
Ouch. That's a tough break for her. Yeah. But wait, I thought you said this went to the Seventh Circuit, right? So what happened there?
Well, that's where things get really interesting. The Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, they actually sided with Swanson on her Fair Housing Act claims.
Really?
Yeah. They said she had told a plausible enough story of discrimination to let her case move forward.
So the court thought her story, the way she presented everything, was strong enough to suggest there might be discrimination.
Exactly. But of course, there's a twist. Judge Posner, you know, that judge with a really sharp legal mind.
Yeah, I know Judge Posner.
He actually wrote a dissenting opinion. He wasn't buying it. He thought a simple appraisal error was the more likely explanation. And he even warned about, you know, the danger of letting these weaker cases drag defendants through long and expensive legal battles.
Yeah, that makes sense. Courts need to find a balance, right? Protecting people from discrimination, but also preventing lawsuits that are just frivolous.
Right. And that's what makes Swanson such a fascinating case. So how do you explain the difference between Swanson's discrimination claims that they allowed to proceed and her fraud claims that got dismissed?
Oh, that's a good question.
You see, the court made it very clear. To prove fraud, you need to bring a lot more to the table, especially right at the beginning.
Like more specifics.
Exactly. They upheld the dismissal of Swanson's fraud claims, and they said she needed much more detailed evidence for those accusations.
So it's almost like different types of claims need different levels of proof.
Absolutely. You see, for discrimination, sometimes a really strong narrative, one that raises some serious suspicion, is enough to get things started. You don't always need a smoking gun right away. But with fraud, you gotta bring receipts. You need hard evidence from the very beginning, not just a hunch.
I see. So I'm starting to understand why this case is so important. It really comes down to that plausibility thing. Like, what's enough to make the court think, hey, this might be something, let's look into it, versus what's just pure speculation?
Precisely. And that's a question courts are still trying to figure out, especially when it comes to discrimination, you know, where finding that clear-cut direct evidence can be really tough. But Swanson v. Citibank does give us some valuable insight into how a strong narrative can sometimes be the key to getting justice.
Wow, this is super interesting. I'm hooked already. We should definitely break down the legal details of Swanson a bit more. So the Seventh Circuit thought Swanson's story was good enough, you know, convincing enough to keep going with the case. What exactly did they find so compelling about what she was saying?
Well, they really honed in on the specifics, the details that Swanson included in her complaint. She didn't just throw out a general claim of discrimination, right? She gave details, you know, about the loan denial, those very different appraisals. She even kind of hinted at the racial dynamics going on. It wasn't just a feeling she had. She presented a whole picture. And the court said, yeah, this is enough to make us worry that there might be discrimination here.
So, even though she didn't have that smoking gun evidence, the court was willing to give her a chance, at least at this stage of things.
Exactly. Remember, this was just a motion to dismiss. They weren't saying Swanson was going to win her whole case, just that her story made enough sense to warrant more investigation. And they really stressed that she didn't need to present all the evidence right there and then. They even used this great analogy. They said, a coherent story, not evidence, is enough at this stage.
I like that. That's a good analogy. It's like reading the first chapter of a book, right? You don't know the ending yet, but it should grab your attention and make you want to read more.
Precisely. Now, Judge Posner, remember him, he had a completely different take in his dissent. He was way more skeptical.
Yeah.
He pointed out that Swanson didn't provide any comparator evidence. You know what I mean? Like, she didn't give examples of white applicants who were treated better in the same kind of situation.
So he wanted to see a side-by-side comparison to really nail down that discrimination angle.
Right. He thought the difference in the appraisals could just be a mistake, not necessarily racial bias. He also brought up a really important point about what this could mean for lawsuits in general. Defending against a discrimination lawsuit is a big deal. It's expensive. It takes time, even if the claims turn out to be baseless. He was worried that just letting cases go forward based on a narrative alone without stronger evidence could be unfair to defendants.
That's a good point. We don't want a system where anyone can just make an accusation and automatically force the other side into this huge legal battle.
Exactly. But, you know, the majority opinion actually addressed that concern. They were clear that their decision was limited, you know, narrow. They weren't saying Swanson had already proven her case, just that she'd presented enough of a story to clear that initial hurdle.
Sounds like they're walking a tightrope, trying to make sure legitimate claims get heard, but also preventing those frivolous lawsuits.
That's it. And that's what makes Swanson so interesting to look at. It exposes this tension between access to justice and protecting defendants from accusations that aren't true. And that's a super important conversation to have, especially in discrimination law, where finding that direct evidence can be so difficult.
It's also interesting to think about this case in the context of the 2009 financial crisis, right? I mean, Citibank had all that federal money to increase lending, and yet they denied a loan to a qualified African-American woman based on an appraisal that might have been wrong. I can see why that raises red flags.
Yeah, you're absolutely right to bring up that context. That financial crisis was a big deal lurking in the background. You had banks being told to lend more, but also being careful not to take on too much risk. That really adds another layer to Swanson's claims.
Makes you wonder, would her case have the same result today? I mean, the whole lending scene has changed so much. New rules, technology, all that.
You're hitting on something really important. Swanson was decided back in 2010. Think of all that's changed since then. New algorithms are being used to assess risk. They're using different data points. And there's way more awareness now about potential bias in lending. It'd be really interesting to see how the courts would handle a case like this today.
So we've got this back and forth between the majority and dissenting opinions, the whole financial crisis thing going on, and all these changes in lending practices. It's a lot to think about. But before we dive into the details of those fraud claims, I want to hear more about your thoughts on storytelling in legal cases. I mean, the court really seemed to focus on Swanson's narrative. Why is that so important, especially for discrimination cases?
That's a great question, and it really gets at the heart of why Swanson is such an important case. You see, telling a story, creating a narrative, that's often the key to getting justice in discrimination cases. And why? Well, because discrimination itself is often really sneaky, really subtle. It's not usually some blatant in-your-face thing. It's woven into policies and practices that seem neutral on the surface. It works in the shadows.
So you're saying a powerful story, a good narrative, can help expose those hidden biases that might otherwise just fly under the radar.
Exactly. It's about connecting the dots, showing the court the whole picture. Especially when there's no direct evidence of discrimination, a well-told story can give the court the context they need to understand what was really motivating certain actions, you know, the intentions behind them. It helps them see the forest for the trees, as they say.
That makes sense. A good story can make people feel empathy, it can show patterns of behavior, and ultimately, it can make that argument for discrimination much stronger. But of course, like Judge Posner pointed out, we have to be careful too. We can't just let stories go wild without any real evidence to back them up.
You're right. It's finding that balance. A good story can be a powerful tool for justice, but those stories have to be rooted in facts, and they need evidence to support them as the case goes on. We can't rely on stories alone, but we can't ignore their power to shine a light on complex issues like discrimination.
This whole case is making me think differently about storytelling, not just in law, but in life too. Sometimes a really well-told story can change people's minds, even open the door to justice. But okay, let's switch gears now and talk about those fraud claims that Swanson included. Why didn't those work out for her? Why did the court dismiss them?
Well, the court was very clear about this. To make accusations of fraud, you need a lot more proof, especially right from the start. There's a specific rule, it's called Rule 9B, and it requires a lot more detail than a typical discrimination claim. You can't just say, hey, I think they tried to cheat me.
So Swanson couldn't just say, this appraisal seems off, I think they're trying to lowball me. She needed to give more solid proof that they were deliberately trying to mislead her.
Exactly. She didn't show how Citibank was trying to defraud her or how she relied on any lies they might have told. It's like the court was saying, hold on, fraud is serious. You can't just throw that word around without some solid evidence.
So like if she had some internal emails from Citibank, you know, employees saying something like, let's purposely undervalue this property so we can deny her the loan, that would have made a difference.
Bingo. That's the kind of evidence Rule 9B wants to see. It's all about preventing these vague accusations of fraud that can really hurt a company. Imagine someone shouting fire in a packed theater when there's no fire. That's what they're trying to prevent.
That's a good analogy. So the bar is higher for alleging fraud because it means someone is intentionally trying to deceive you, whereas discrimination can be more subtle, even unintentional sometimes.
That's a great way to put it. Discrimination often involves biases people don't even realize they have, these ingrained patterns of behavior that are hard to pin down with hard evidence. But fraud, that usually means deliberate actions, calculated steps to mislead, and that leaves a much clearer trail. The legal system gets that and sets different standards for proving each one.
I see. So that's where the differences between proving discrimination and proving fraud really stand out. Swanson's case shows that a strong narrative can get your discrimination claim started, but you need a lot more than just a good story when you're talking fraud. You need strong evidence, clear facts, and specific accusations from the very beginning.
Absolutely. And anyone thinking about filing a lawsuit that includes fraud claims, remember, you have to be ready to hit hard right away with details and strong evidence. Vague ideas and suspicions just aren't going to cut it. The court wants to see receipts.
Well, this deep dive has been really eye-opening. We've covered a lot, from the power of storytelling in these cases to the tougher standards for fraud. But before we wrap up, any final thoughts on what this case means more broadly? What are the key takeaways, especially for anyone who might find themselves in a situation like Swanson's?
That's a great question. I think one of the biggest takeaways from Swanson is this. In discrimination cases, telling your story in a compelling way can be super powerful. You don't always need that smoking gun to get things moving. What you need is a story that makes sense, that raises real concerns about discrimination, and it needs to be specific and told with conviction.
It really is amazing, you know, how much we learn just from looking at this one case. Discrimination law, fraud, even how powerful storytelling can be.
It shows us the challenges courts are facing. This balancing act, especially now with lending practices and technology constantly changing.
Yeah, and speaking of those changes, I keep thinking about how Swanson might play out today. We've got all these algorithms now, data-driven stuff to figure out risk. Do you think that changes things?
That's the million-dollar question. Legal folks are still debating that, you know? I mean, on the one hand, you could say these algorithms are supposed to take out the human bias, right? Make lending decisions more objective, more fair.
Right, yeah.
But here's the other side. Some people worry that these algorithms might actually make existing biases worse, especially if they're trained on data that's already biased, reflecting past discrimination.
So even if you take out the human element, you could still end up with unfair results if the information the algorithm is using is flawed from the start.
Exactly. Imagine baking a cake with ingredients that are already bad. Doesn't matter how fancy your recipe is, how great your oven is, if the flour is no good, that cake is going to be a disaster. It's the same with these algorithms. If they're using data that already reflects racial bias, economic discrimination, those same problems could get baked in, even if the goal is to be neutral.
That's kind of scary to think about. Do you think Swanson would have the same outcome today? Would the court find her story as convincing now with all these tech advancements?
It's tough to say for sure. we're in hypothetical territory here. Plus, legal decisions, they're always based on so many different things.
Right, yeah.
But I think Swanson brings up some really important questions that are even more relevant now than back then in 2010. Like, how do we make sure this new lending technology is being used fairly? How do we stop algorithmic bias? And what about people who feel like they've been discriminated against? How do they get justice when a lot of these lending decisions are being made by machines?
Yeah, that's a lot to think about. Big questions. And we definitely don't have all the answers yet. But Swanson gives us a place to start, you know, a way to approach these issues. Even in a world where data and algorithms are taking over, storytelling still has power.
Right.
Context still matters.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to be careful, make sure the legal system keeps up with all this crazy fast technological change.
I totally agree. Swanson is more than just a case about one loan. It's about this whole relationship between technology, law, and social justice. A case that will keep being relevant for a long time, I think.
I think that's a great way to put it. Swanson v. Citibank. It makes us think about fairness, access to justice, and all the challenges we're facing in this rapidly changing world. It reminds us that the law, it has to change and adapt to new situations.
And that we all have a part to play in making sure that happens, right?
Yeah.
Whether we're lawyers, tech people, or just regular citizens who want a more just and fair world.
Couldn't have said it better myself. Well, that wraps up our deep dive into Swanson v. Citibank. Thanks for joining us. We hope you'll be back for another deep dive into the world of law and how it affects all of us.